Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking titles. There's the Premier League title and another weekend of twists and turns for Liverpool, Manchester City and Arsenal. There's the title of Harry Kane's England deputy and the battle between Ivan Toney and Ollie Watkins and Dominic Solanke. And there's the title of the most stupid tackle in football as Mason Holgate ensures Sheffield United get thrashed by Brighton. We'll also be talking about Rasmus Højlund and Roy Hodgson, and joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have a football journalist and writer whose title and nickname amongst us editors is The Postie, as she always delivers. It's Alison Rudd. We've got a former footballer who was known as Tony Goal and the Ice Cream Man during his career as a striker. It's Tony Cascarino. And another former footballer who, upon retirement, started a column called The Journeyman, but is now affectionately known amongst Times sports editors as National Rail, because like the trains in this country, his copy is always late. Gregor Robertson is here too.
Slanderous stuff.
Is it slanderous?
No, it's not. It's entirely true.
It's entirely true. And that nickname, listeners, is in fact something I made up this morning for the purposes of that intro. But I'm going to be sticking with it because I thought it was quite good, National Rail.
Yeah, I prefer a journeyman.
Fine. Yeah, but you're not anymore. You're sticking with us. So National Rail. Tony, I'd like you to tell us a bit more about the Ice Cream Man because I've never heard this.
Chad Charlton called me the Ice Cream Man, first of all, because he could never say Cascarino. Just said the Ice Cream Man.
Is that actually right?
Yeah, it's exactly the truth, yeah.
If and you it, say it very reason. Fast, it does sound like Cascarino, doesn't it? Ice Cream Man.
Ice Cream Man. Tony Ice Cream Man.
He never called me Tony, and he never called me Cascarino. So he never
Tony's
mentioned...
very hard.
He just would say Kaza or the Ice Cream Man.
Kaza or the Ice Cream Man.
Yeah.
I mean, truly wonderful. Thing is, I was actually hoping that would be a really broad story around how you once bought for 99s for all the lads and something. But no, it's actually much more simple than that, but I think actually more enjoyable. Thank you for that. What a wonderful way to start. But we move to the Premier League title and Manchester City's surprise draw with Chelsea. No one saw that coming, least of all us on this podcast after slagging off Chelsea all season. But I want to start with Chelsea very briefly because it obviously then immediately turned to Manchester City. Tone, in your column this morning, you said that for the first time, unlike other times where there's little moments for Chelsea and we go, oh, they're a bit good, and then you've kind of said, no, they're still not great. You thought that this performance was actually showed some real promise.
More in the way of them being a threat and how they could hurt City. I thought that was intriguing. I mean, if you take over the two games, it's been 5-5. They drew 4-4 at Stamford Bridge, Man City, and it's gone 1-1 at the Etihad. And Chelsea's performance was... I felt it was energetic. I thought Chilwell handed Foden as well as anybody I've seen this year, which was really interesting how well he played. De Sarsi, centre-half, best game he's had in a Chelsea shirt. Look, if you look at it and want to dissect it completely, Erling Haaland the week before had two chances, hardly had a sniff at goal. At the weekend, he had five or six great chances, didn't take any of them. It could have been a much higher scoreline for both teams because Chelsea caused... City problems, like I said. Haaland is not going to do that very often. Yeah. You know, his record tells you that. He's a goal scorer, and two or three of them, there was a couple of headers that I felt were a bit harder than they actually looked because it's the ball that's just above you. It's a bit too high, and you can't get above it to head it down. He had a couple of them in the game, and then there was a couple of poor finishes in there as well, but that ain't going to happen very often. But fair play to Chelsea because they were a threat. And they kept it as tight, and their workload was brilliant. Certainly, Fernandes, Caicedo, Gallagher, a lot of energy there in that side. So Chelsea fans would be delighted with that performance, and probably a little bit gutted they didn't actually get 3 points as well.
Yeah,
I can't believe it. I can't believe what I've just heard.
What? You still, still reeling about the ice cream man thing?
Well, that is, it's making me want a 99 now, so I'm very suggestible. But also, I can't believe how positive you're being about Chelsea.
Well, no,
they were so, they had that game. As you say, they were proving they could cause a threat and they went so defensive.
Yeah,
Pochettino's substitutions, what were they saying to the team? I don't have faith in you. I don't have faith in you to win this. They got deeper and deeper, invited. If you want to explain to someone who knows nothing about football, what does the phrase inviting pressure mean? You'd say, look at what Chelsea did towards the end of that game.
Is that not fair against Manchester City, though?
No, but they were Chelsea, and they were doing well. They were causing them problems. They looked unsettled. Instead, they seemed to just sort of withdraw into themselves.
Is that not the rhythm of a game, though?
Yeah, even no,
the
way they've done it all season, Chelsea. If you watch every game, they've never thought, oh, we've got momentum here. We've
Man
taken
City
the lead
home,
and we'll go for it. They didn't.
Man City at home, they did that. They went after City because they were losing the game. I felt...
They're better when they're losing
the game. It's hard when you have a five or nearly six forwards getting in dangerous areas where inevitably you don't let runners go. So you're sort of forced to go that way. Do you see what I mean? You get forced to defend.
I think the way that Chelsea caused City problems was from being in a low block. Yeah. Like I know, obviously that
they
receded more and more, but
and put on defenders.
But the way that they set up was to basically a back five, although Gusto and the wing backs were really quite brave in the way that they tried to mark the wingers, and Caicedo and Fernandes filled in the little gaps. I think you could describe it as a fairly smart performance, which is rare. You know, it's very different too because they have to City came right on top of them and left a lot of space to exploit in behind. Mm. And the way they exploited that was very smart. And that's not the kind of opponent that they come up against most weeks. And it's easier for them to exploit that space than when they're playing. They're normally the team playing against a side with a low block. Mm. So I thought it was a smart performance, which I haven't said very many times this season.
You certainly haven't. Very quickly on Ben Chilwell, because I wanted to ask you, former left backs union, is it him? If he's fit, is he a better option for England than Luke Shaw as a more complete player? Luke Shaw obviously excellent going forward.
I think yes, but Shaw has been brilliant for England, and particularly
has,
in tournaments. Yeah. And I think Gareth Southgate puts a lot of weight in that. It's the same sort of argument with Harry Maguire. He's arguably better for England than he is for United, although he's been good for United when he's been fit. But Chilwell at his best is, I think you're right, I think he is a more sort of complete all-round wing back.
Yeah, and very important to this Chelsea side. On to City then. Paul Hurst has written this morning, City's form against top sides is a concern. I was discussing this piece with him over the weekend, and with it is a table showing the Big Six Premier League table. So this includes Chelsea and Manchester United, not the kind of Big Six on form, of course. Arsenal are top. Six games, 12 points, sorry. Tottenham second. City in third. 7 points from six games. Do you agree with Hursty that City's... performances against these top sides is a concern, Gregor?
I mean, if you can say a concern is after a kind of 11 match winning run, that's about the only concern you can find for Manchester City.
But just to come back to that, that is the kind of gist of Hursty's piece, is that he said Pep Guardiola in the press conferences before this game said,
remember my sentence.
I'm saying this is not this. We make it look easy, and this is your point. They make it look easy, but it's not easy to win this many games, and that's why you will then stumble against Chelsea, and everyone go, bloody hell, they can't even beat Chelsea.
Yeah, look, there are some worries. I think the biggest worry would, as Hursty also pointed out in this piece, is Akanji. When Akanji was asked to play in that kind of midfield role, that hybrid role, he's just nowhere near as comfortable as John Stones, and it's kind of becoming increasingly hard to see why he keeps trying to do that. Because we saw how much Chelsea were able to exploit the lack of cover when City were attacking, on the counter attack. So that's an issue, and well, Haaland, I'm sure won't have a miss as many chances again in the next game.
Yeah, I wish he hadn't. As a man who made him triple captain in his fantasy football team. Cheers, Erling. Thanks very much. No, you're quite right, and we shouldn't dwell too much on Manchester City's disaster, the collapse, the breakdown. because they'll almost certainly win another 11 in a row.
It does matter, doesn't it?
It does,
of course.
Their
form is against the top teams, because if it's only in their hands if they win those crucial games, and they've got to face Liverpool. And if they're not very good against the top teams, they're not going to win the title.
Quite right. Speaking of Liverpool, who was there? Who could we possibly ask about Liverpool? Amid the chaos and madness of their form this season, the madness on the pitch, the madness off it, it's all going crazy. But Alison Rudd, there is a man of calming reassurance, isn't there? Tell us who he is.
If you're privileged enough to go to a Saturday game for the Times, and you have a colleague who's going to do the report for the Sunday Times, you go into what is known as the mix zone, and you wait for the players to walk past you. And every club has a different personality with this. Some clubs ask you who you want to speak to, and some clubs allow you to grab who you can grab. And Liverpool are fairly flexible. A lot of players hobbled past us with their protective boots on, knee braces on. That's a bit of a worry for Liverpool, the injuries. But anyway, it started to feel a bit like, ooh, wobble, wobble, wobble. But then out walked Virgil van Dijk. I've seen him before and spoke to him in a mix zone before, but he is... You have to meet the man to realise what an impact he probably has as captain of that team. He has the hugest of auras, very calm presence. He has that look in his eyes where he treats everything slightly ironically, like, okay, I'll tolerate these questions sort of thing. But he just exudes calm and seriousness, and you can imagine being in the dressing room or walking out with him and having concerns about whatever the concerns might be, too many young players in the team perhaps, or the jitters of being top of the table, and him being able to convince everybody, don't worry, we've got this. I mean, he really has got an aura. I mean, the minute he signed for Liverpool, I said he's going to be the captain. You could just tell, and you can tell. Even if he wasn't actually the captain, he'd be the captain. He's just so... And he's clever and analytical and authentic. So when he says we have the ability to cope with being top of the table and to absorb any injuries, you believe he knows something. You know, he's not just saying it. He knows something. He knows they've got it. So... It was really nice having watched players hobble through the mix zone to see somebody look like, yeah, no, it's a bit of a shame, but it's fine. We've got Salah. It's cool. It's all cool.
Should add to that, there really is only two players who stop in the mix zone for Liverpool, and it's Van Dijk and Andy Robertson.
Well, it's partly a language thing.
Exactly. No, I'm not. That's not criticism, but both do kind of omit something really, like Robertson's just a determined sort of, he's got that stare. Yeah. he approaches everything like, don't worry about it, guys. Like,
I saw a lot of that in Scotland, funny enough, when I was there.
I thought that was a bit of pro-Scotland agenda creeping in. But also, the other thing about Virgil van Dijk is that he's been brilliant on the pitch. Tony, this is something that you had mentioned before, maybe a waning in his skills and his performance. Before, not currently, no. Of course. He's been fantastic, hasn't he, in terms of his performance?
Yeah, I say we built him. He's always been a terrific player. And I think the game's easy for him. And I think that's the only stumbling block with Virgil, is that I think he could get a little bit bored at times, or, you know, and he needs that adrenaline to play his very best, because he's such a... And he's blisteringly quick. He's tremendous in the air. He's got incredible composure. He's got a great diagonal ball, which he'd done against Brentford a few times. He has so much quality that I do think the only trouble for him is if he just slightly switches off.
Which he can't in this Liverpool team, because there's chaos and madness happening all around him.
Maybe that's a fact. I mean, he's had a number of different partners as well, but he's always been Klopp's number one.
Yeah.
And I think he knows that. He's number one. You know, you do know as a player sometimes when you're in a side where who may be the captain or not, or someone who might get the headlines, but deeply, really, he's the number one. That's sort of what Alisson's alluding to.
Yeah. Ever been anyone's number one, Tim? Apart from mine, of course.
I don't even be the number one at home. What time have I got on the football field? Andy Townsend used to get special treatment off Jack Charlton.
And you're still annoyed about it?
Well, no, I used to find it annoying because me and Andy roomed together. Jack would walk in and he'd be all listening to Andy and I'd try and get in a word edgeways and, yeah, okay, okay, okay. And Andy, right, we need... And I used to find it... I'd say, Jack, what about from a forwards perspective? And he trusted that when he made him captain, he was like that. But sometimes they just... And also having a relationship. It's funny enough, I'm going right off pissed here. I went to Andy Townsend's house this week and he showed me a letter from Jack. It was about tickets for a cup final because Villa were in the cup final and they were playing and Jack wanted to go and asked Andy for tickets. And it's a written letter. And at the end of it, he said, have a look at what he put at the end of it. He said, I'll pay for them. He said he had no intention of paying. It was literally, you get me them.
Yeah.
You know, and that was Jack. But it was lovely. And Andy's got it in a little frame.
What food stuff did he call Andy?
Yeah.
What false... Jack was really basic on lots of stuff
apart from your nickname,
but because he just couldn't say Tony Casquino, he would just say Ice Cream Man.
Anyway, Jack Charlton might not have always wanted to listen to you, Tony, but I do, and I want to know your views on Arsenal and their ability to score absolutely tons of goals, seemingly, without a striker. A few months ago, we were saying they need to sign Ivan Toney, but now, as long as they've got Bukayo Saka and the rest of the forwards, they seem to have found this way to score loads of goals again.
Well, Tom, managers and coaches are paid lots of money to make decisions that we wouldn't see popular or the right one, and you know the drive for getting a centre-forward to the club. Tweaking the team and making Trossard, you know, a versatile striker come false number nine has paid huge dividends. First of all, Trossard's a great finisher. I remember watching him at Brighton, he gets things out of his feet. You can see, if you watched him train, you could tell he's a finisher by just the way he takes goals. I think that's been a blessing for Arteta. With that, Odegaard has come into the fold again. Saka's found his form on the right. There's been a real confidence boost to that forward line by the amount of goals they're getting. And I, you know, sometimes in defeat, they had that bad period where they lost to Fulham, didn't they? And lost to West Ham at home. And it looked like the wheels are going to fall off. And then they've just gone they've just literally smashed everybody. The Liverpool victory was a big one for them in the league. It really was. I think they found something that day by the way they beat Liverpool, because they were the better team on the day. They found something there that just has taken them onto a... I'd never thought in any danger of Arsenal not getting 3 points against Burnley away. And we know Burnley have obviously become one of the worst teams where they are now. They conceded.
I think the team podcast five aside would get 3 points against Burnley, to be honest.
Yeah, so it's a fair point. But I do
She doesn't mean that.
I do, going back to my original point, I do think that is the ability of a coach or a manager who's decided we've got other options to play or other ways to play with the personnel we've got, and I'm going to make this work.
Mm.
Is anyone ever going to pick Odegaard up on the edge of the box, though?
Every time Saka
and Martinelli run down, and everyone bombs into the box, and Odegaard just sort of drifts into that little space on the edge of the box, and no one.
You're offering to do it? Come out of retirement?
I think even if the Times podcast, you know, five-a-side team was, I would do that job. Yeah.
I mean, you've just completely distracted me now because all I can think about is who would play in midfield if we've got Toney up front, you in defence. Who's going to be in midfield anyway? But talking about Arsenal, Gregor, we talked last week about West Ham and defeats, heavy defeats. What does it do in a dressing room and with for a team when you've won 6-0 and 5-0 after beating Liverpool, because, you know, Toney said that was a massive thing, but to then win, you know, 11 goals in two games, non-conceded, you mean you must be absolutely flying, aren't you?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, Havertz in Charlotte's piece today was kind of saying, look, if we score two goals in the next week, then you guys will be saying we need a striker again. So, like, they obviously know what the kind of narrative and the conversation is outside the club. Mm. But as Toney says, they've found a way. You do have to caveat that West Ham were abysmal and Burnley are abysmal.
Yeah. Ooh, harsh.
I mean, they are. They can't
defend. Abysmal's fine. Saying we beat them at football is a bit toppy, I'd say.
More broadly speaking, they've now scored more goals than City. They've got the same goal difference as Liverpool. You know, this was the question mark about Arsenal. Are they going to have some... Have they got the focal point? Have they got someone who's going to score enough goals for them to win the title? Everything suggests that doesn't matter.
Did you see the crossover in the two pieces, Tom, Mr. Editor? So in my piece...
It's going to look bad if I didn't, but go on.
In my piece, I talked about how Virgil said the key to remaining calm... Well, the key is to remain calm in the if you're top of the table in your title race. And the key to remaining calm is to enjoy the football. And Kai Havertz, who was interviewed in Charlotte's piece, says exactly the same thing. It's about remembering to enjoy your football. So they're both cottoned on. Both teams have cottoned on to the fact that...
And I put them on the same spread in the newspaper as well. It's like almost like...
The symmetry was astonishing.
Other point is that without Zinchenko, Kiwior's coming has just kind of seamlessly come in, and they've found another way. They too, with White on the other side stepping in. So, it, you know, again, last season, there were question marks when Zinchenko was out of the team, when Jesus was out of the team. They're both out of the team just now. Mm. The only one left is that anyone can find now about Arsenal is if Saliba was to come out of the team.
There's an irony in that, Gregor, isn't there? Because they were brought in, the two players who have come from success in a winning way from City, to add to Arsenal, and he's ended up, well, obviously Gabriel Jesus is injured, but Zinchenko feels like now he's going to find it very difficult to get into this team.
Yeah, Jesus is still in their best team. Yeah. Zinchenko, you would have said that until very recently, but now you're starting to think, are they better defensively without him?
Yeah.
And they have found a solution to still dominate in midfield by allowing someone else to step in. So,
speaking of solutions and problems, Alison, you touched on it with injuries. Gregor, you mentioned John Stones at Manchester City. Do we wonder whether the solutions to problems, managers being paid a lot of money, Tony, to fix things, and injuries, Liverpool have had a lot of them, might actually decide this title race? Because you're talking about Arsenal there with losing some key players, but finding solutions. Liverpool, you know, maybe if they lost Van Dijk, that would be incredibly, well, disastrous, you would say. City, John Stones becoming a big issue, as Paul Hurst is talking about, and you, Gregor. Could injuries decide this? Alison, are you worried about Liverpool's injuries?
Well, I don't want to think about Van Dijk being injured, first of all. And why would you jinx that? Why would you even suggest that, Tom?
Which it's the very, reverse jinx. I'm a Lincoln rude, City fan, and League One, that's how we do things down here.
No,
it's the reverse jinx we go for.
Seeing Curtis Jones and Jota go off before half time and you know, probably relatively serious and keep them out, you do think, oh, you know, Alisson wasn't playing, Trent wasn't playing, Szoboszlai wasn't playing, and obviously if you win the game you don't feel panicked, but it didn't feel like an overall panic situation, because then you get Mo Salah coming off the bench needing just one run at goal to get his feel back for it, missed the target, but after that he was absolutely scintillating, amazing, and you think, well, that's okay if you can get people back at a similar rate to the ones you're losing, so you sort of have this turnover where your depth of squad, particularly in attack, because that's what was said at the start of the season. Wow, you know, if Liverpool win the title, it's going to be because look at the options up front. And it seems sort of slightly fantastical that they would need them all, but they do. They do. And so it's fine. They've all played minutes. They've all played in different positions. And you do feel, unless there's something catastrophic happens, that Liverpool do have the depth to be able to cope with the two most recent injuries. Clearly, it's not pleasant. But there was something about seeing Salah stripping off earlier than he was going to, and thinking, okay, this is okay.
Reassures also, everything.
Also the youngsters. Liverpool have a group of youngsters that have already been sort of bedded into the team and are there and ready. Joel Kwanzaa, Bradley again, what a player. Mm. Harvey Elliott, he's still a youngster, but he's played probably nearly 100 games for Liverpool now. That's another big kind of weapon for them.
See, I would put in that, Curtis Jones, for me, has grown into a proper player. Mm. And what I saw of him a year ago, really lots of talent, still needed a little bit. He needed to man up slightly physically. I think this season he's been... And I think it's a big blow that if he's injured for Liverpool, that's going to hurt them, because I think he's their best midfield player.
Interesting. Sounds like we're all tipping Liverpool for the title, but I'm going to give you a chance to clarify. One team, no justifications, no sitting on the fence, Gregor. Just tell me who's going to win the Premier League title.
City.
Alison?
Me and Van Dijk say Liverpool.
Tone?
City.
Arsenal for me, just to keep the Arsenal fans happy. Stick with us, because we do think you've got a chance at the title, I promise. Finishing part one with a mention of Roy Hodgson, the Crystal Palace manager, currently, still. Of course, we wish him well, not been feeling very well. Alison, have you spoken to him? Is he okay?
We've exchanged texts politely. He's home, seems fine. obviously it's always distressing when something happens to you medically and you don't know what's going on. But you would, if you were writing a drama about sport, you would not have the manager of a team who everyone's expecting to be sacked within 10 minutes to collapse on the training pitch.
Indeed, a unique scenario.
Before that news has come out. It was utterly bizarre. And I would argue the whole thing has... Steve Parish is regarded as one of the more forward-thinking, intelligent chairmen, and he did step in single-handedly to save the club from administration. That's fantastic. But the way he's handled the current crisis, and I'm not even sure it was a crisis at Crystal Palace, I've not been happy about it. A lot of people feel it's a bit strange, lacking dignity. I wrote a piece for the Sunday Times saying if anybody in the world other than Roy Hodgson was manager of Crystal Palace at the moment, who would Steve Parish be calling? It would be Roy Hodgson. And the fact he seems to have forgotten that fact, it seems to me slightly ludicrous. If you list all the reasons why Palace are, they're not in the relegation zone. There are quite a few teams worse than Crystal Palace. The reasons they're struggling on recent form, and they've had some bad luck in games as well, it's injuries. They don't have the depth of squad. They don't have the money to have depth of squad. The players we've all gushed about for the past sort of year, 18 months, they're all injured. That is not the manager's fault. And to have put out teams that have, I think, have shown quite a lot of character and they've just buckled towards the end of a few games against bigger clubs, that shows somebody, a manager who's more or less getting the best out of the team that he can. I think it's slightly odd to assume that someone who's never managed in the Premier League can come in and somehow work magic when the same players will still be injured. But for it to be an open secret that Oliver Glasner's coming in and still not to have told Roy Hodgson this at training. When Roy Hodgson collapsed at training, he had not been told this, you know, you might want to say goodbye, or should we shape your departure in a certain way, Roy? Do you want some input on how we do this? They hadn't kept him in the loop at all. Just seems, given he was manager for 4 years, gave them stability, stepped in as an emergency manager. Then when he was about to go and live abroad with his wife, they then begged him to come back for a one season stint. It just seems a shoddy way of handling it.
Tony, in your column this morning in the Times, you had not necessarily a differing view, but a slight counterpoint, more about the realities of football, modern football.
Well, obviously, it was unfortunate, the timing and the circumstances of how he, you know, collapsed in training. It's just straight away I felt, wow, football does this all the time. Football clubs, people, whatever you want to call it, tapping up other people to come and get the jobs. When Brighton beat Palace 4-1, I immediately thought, I'd be amazed if Palace are not looking already for a manager. That's just the brutal reality of football. I don't like a lot of it. I think loads of clubs, you could probably say every club, have been guilty of it at some time, of going after someone who's in a job, and you've still got a manager in a job. It's one of the dark sides of football. I mean, what got me was when I read on Friday night that Sheffield Wednesday were playing Millwall and they're in a hotel in Greenwich and they were staying there. Sheffield Wednesday went in the hotel and Steve Parish and Glasson, the new manager, or so-called new manager, be careful what I say there, were having a meeting and were disturbed. I find that really weird.
Bad planning.
Well, just think of it, you know. Did you not do your homework that maybe Sheffield Wednesday might be here or somebody might be there? If it is going to be done, it's got to be done ultra private. And Roy Hodgson should know. I think for me, the biggest thing is because just out of sense of loyalty, you would say to Roy, and like Alison, and Alison knows Roy very, very well, obviously, that he would have known before they would have that meeting that they were preparing for a change and we are going to meet this guy. Then you're totally up front. Then you haven't got, you know, Roy shouldn't be in a position of being angry about the club he supported and worked at have gone behind his back without him knowing. Surely he deserves that. That's where I'd criticise the club. But for actually doing it and preparing for this moment, I think that's just every club in football, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I mean,
the problem is you need a replacement ready before you make the final call.
Yeah.
So yeah, clearly they've not done it well, and it doesn't reflect very well on Palace as a club or Steve Parish. But I mean, he's not handled many sort of decisions that are kind of breaking from the norm or breaking the mould, sorry, very well at all. Mm. If you look at De Boer, you look at Vieira. Any sort of breakup. I was looking at before I went to the Chelsea game, the Palace Chelsea game the other week. The managers that they've had in the Premier League are like Neil Warnock, Sam Allardyce, Tony Pulis, Alan Pardew, and Roy Hodgson. Those two were the kind of the different ones. I don't blame Palace fans for wanting something new. I don't blame it. I've said it before. I don't think he should have been given the job again in the summer. But the way they're handling this now is pretty terrible, and it's not the first time as well that. Whatever, you know, Palace's sort of the machinations of their decision making are being played out in the media, like before anything's actually concluded. Mm. That doesn't reflect well on Palace either.
Well, it's a situation that is changing and updating all the time. And of course, Palace in action against Everton tonight. So by the time you're listening to this podcast, they might have a new manager. They might have someone else in the dugout. Who knows? If you've got views on who will win the title or suggestions for a topic or... maybe you want to tell us where we've gone wrong, like listener David Barry, who correctly emailed to point out that I had recently trotted out the lazy myth that Dennis Law had in fact relegated Manchester United, which is not true. Thank you, David. Then do get in touch, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. But for now, stick with us. Up next, we're talking strikers and stupid tackles.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark and I'm joined today by Alison Rudd, Tony Cascarino and Gregor Robertson. And Gregor, it's your piece that we're going to leap in on. Ollie Watkins, Villa's main man, staking a claim as Kane's understudy. Don't want to talk so much about Villa. I want to talk about Watkins because that is all your piece is about in the game. And then we're going to have a little debate about who's better because I've got some interesting stats for you. But first, over to you.
I think he put on a masterclass at the weekend. Clinical finish, the first one, just brilliant. He didn't even touch the ball, and he sold two defenders a dummy. Just rolled them, and then one touch and clinical finish in the bottom corner. And the second one was a brilliant piece of movement. Tony, as Tony will know, it's like the most simple coming short to go in behind to move by a striker. Mm-hmm. But he did it brilliantly at an angle. Villa worked it brilliantly, and he sold Diop a dummy, a brilliant dummy, and again a clinical finish. And I just think his confidence is clearly, you know, blossoming, and he scored more open play goals than any other player in the league. I think only Salah's had more direct goal involvement, so goals or assists this season, and only one more. Watkins has 23, Salah 24. But also, his importance to Villa is underlined by the fact that he's had an involvement in 43% of their their league goals this year. 52% in all competitions. So, like, their top four challenge rests upon his shoulders. I think it's that simple. They've got some other big players. In fact, his partnership with Tielemans is now getting really, is now really interesting, because they lost Boubacar Kamara to an ACL injury, and he's a deep-lying midfielder, and you would think Tielemans is almost a like-for-like replacement. But Emery played him in the number 10, dropped McGinn back, and they're working a really good partnership. They did it in the inside 2 minutes. One of those kind of really incisive passing moves through the centre of the pitch that Villa have become so kind of renowned for, and released to Watkins, and he scored, and he was fractionally offside. It's one of three offside goals at the weekend. He's just...
So you think he's actually in that conversation around, you know, we've just talked about the title race and key players from your Van Dijk's, you know, to going into Saka, you're talking about him. You think Watkins, in terms of that race for fourth, he's up there with Son Heung-min and James Maddison in terms of that good, that important to his team?
Absolutely,
I'm not saying he's as good as them players.
I think he's as important to his team as any player is to their team in the league.
I think Fulham fans were saying they were defeated by Ollie Watkins.
Well, yeah, they were. And I said at the start of this piece that I think he's one of the most complete strikers in the league as well, because, you know, there are players who are better in the air, there's players who are quicker, but not many, actually. He's rapid. Mm. He's really intelligent. He's great with his back to, you know, back to goal as well, and dropping deep to link up play. And as I say as well, I actually think his profile is the closest to Harry Kane's of any other kind of striking option. That's not to say that, you know, Tony would be a great alternative. You know, he's someone who would be an impact player off the bench, and the likelihood is you're going to be that player when you're Kane's understudy. But if the worst were to happen to Harry Kane, I've no doubt that Ollie Watkins should be the next player who steps into the team.
It's very interesting on Watkins, because with that piece about Saka, I was looking at some of the stats and looking at Premier League goals and assists since the start of last season. Erling Haaland, of course, top with 65 total, 52 goals, 13 assists. Then Mo Salah, of course, in second, 34 goals, 21 assists, 55 total. Then the next two, Saka and Watkins, both on 44. And Watkins has actually got more goals, 28 goals, 16 assists.
He's in elite company now.
He's
absolutely
really up there now.
He absolutely is in elite company. And the thing that's quite instructive about Emery, whenever you ask him about Watkins, is he references the other stuff all the time. He's saying, I think his best action today, yeah, like his goal's brilliant, was when he heard back at just before half-time, robbed Fulham midfielder of the ball and set off, I think, Tielemans on a counter. Tielemans should have scored as well. And he's like, that is the thing that he's sort of added to his game, his commitment, his work rate off the ball, his pressing, all that kind of stuff. His goals are really important for us, he said, but that's the stuff that I'm really, really sort of proud of him for, he said.
Tony, he's someone that we've talked about a lot at different stages of his career when we've been doing your column and reflecting on the weekend's action. Sometimes a player that we've wondered, is 8 out of 10 the max he can go? Do you actually think he's got better, and can he get even better than he already has?
Well, I think the fact that Villa got him on a new long-term contract at the start of this season is a clear indication from the manager that we need to keep him, because there's club sniffing. Because Ollie would have vultures hanging over him to try and get him out of Villa Park, without a doubt. Because he's one of them players... There's some players that can light up a game in any moment, but they can be on the fringe of a game. Ollie's always involved. I think that's the big thing. You look at actions that are happening in the game, and then suddenly you'll see a channel run and it'll be Ollie on the left, and then it'll be Ollie on the right. And you sort of think he's going in a lot of areas of the pitch where you don't get goals, which a lot of strikers do.
Yeah. Or you get players who are great at playing on the shoulder, but not quite so good at coming dropping deep to do the link-up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's
what I'm saying. His skill set is so broad. It's like,
but is that something he's improved? Because I remember all three of us talking that he was that player that would run the channels quite a lot. Like you said, under previous Villa managers, he would get in behind and stretch teams. That's what Watkins
then
did.
Dropping down.
And then other players would benefit. Is this down to Emery, or is it him?
Well, no, I always want to credit the player, because, you know, if you want to learn and you want to become a better player, maybe watching Harry Kane develop from a young lad. Because Harry Kane, when I saw him as an 18-year-old at Millwall and then watched him come through at Tottenham, he'd become an improved player because he wanted to learn the game in a different way. And how much more can he give apart from just scoring goals? Ollie Watkins wants to be a more complete player. Not necessarily, look, of course he loves getting goals and bigger numbers, but he also wants to be a far more effective player, because you know, if you think of Villa lost him tomorrow, Alisson talked about Virgil van Dijk and the impact at Liverpool. You look at Ollie Watkins and you think, well, really, who could do that role at Villa? The answer is no one.
No. I think Emery does deserve credit, though, because he has him playing through the centre of the pitch more. And Tony's right about those channel runs and stuff. He's doing them less. When Steven Gerrard was the manager before, this is actually, you know, the 16 months ago, this is where Steven Gerrard, after a 3-0 defeat, lost his job. I was at the game as well, actually. And so many players were like a shadow of themselves. Yeah. And Watkins was one of them. He scored one goal in his opening 11 games of the season. And since then, this has brought up Emery's 50th Premier League game. Villa have won 30 of them. Watkins has been involved in 40 goals. And he's started all but one of those games. He's like, he is the go-to man. He's their talisman now. Yeah. John McGinn, I like to shoehorn John McGinn in, but this isn't a joke either. They love him, and he's really important for Villa. But Watkins is the most irreplaceable player.
Yeah. When I said, you know, giving course you have to compliment a manager because he's given him the tools to be a better player. And this team will be set up for you to show exactly, but you need to do certain things for me.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, Villa were completely, I mean, adding on from what Gregor said, I remember a couple of games I went to last year with Villa and was thinking, wow, they're a really average mid-table team. And they were hovering around that and below under Steven Gerrard. And
Alisson, there's two other men I want to bring into this debate, and I'm going to let you choose who you want to talk about, Ivan Toney or Dominic Solanke.
Oh, I mean, I love them both. But I was
or
at,
you can
I was,
both.
I was, I was at, I was at, I was at Brentford on Saturday, so I ought to probably speak about Ivan Toney, who, if he'd been in better frame of mind on Saturday, could have made it much more difficult for Liverpool. For some reason, I couldn't quite work out what was going on. He treated the ball like it was a lemon meringue pie and he didn't want to destroy
it. Maybe because he's a Liverpool fan and a massive Jurgen Klopp fan. Did you see that hug he gave him at the end
of the
match?
Oh, there was a lot of hugging at the
Goodness
end.
Goodness me.
A lot of hugging.
Outrageous,
at the end.
Ivan. But anyway.
It's probably not the best day to talk about after that because I felt his finishing was peculiar. I doubt he actually thought it was a lemon meringue pie, but that's how it looked from the stands. But he did score. He did score and you sort of feel like you know he will. And I've said this before, people, because he's got an attitude, Toney, and a sort of degree of arrogance, which is fine. I think a lot of strikers need that. People think he's one-dimensional as well. He's only interested in scoring goals. But if you watch him live, he is remarkably unselfish, which I actually love from a striker. And Neil Mopay, I think, was heading into joke category as a centre-forward. But since Tony's come back from his suspension, Neil Mopay is completely transformed. And he gazes at Toney like he loves him. And the runs they make from each other, the intuition they have, and they will run for each other. And they will pass to each other. There is a brightness there and an understanding there, and Toney has had it with Mbeumo as well. He's very unselfish and he will cover vast swathes of the pitch where he sees it's necessary to do so. I think he's an intriguing player for that reason, in fact, because he's tall and has a physical presence. It's easy to think of him as a one-dimensional sort of striker, but he's not. He has great, great intuition and reading of the game. And I think in terms of, if you want to talk about class, the class of a player who ought to be on the international stage, I think he should. And I've always maintained I think he'd work well with Harry Kane, not instead of Harry Kane.
That's an interesting point and I want to come back to it. But just to bring in Dominic Solanke to complete the trio, looking at that table that I've done of statistics relating to Bukayo Saka, Toney, sneaking in at number 10 for Premier League goals and assists since last season, just behind Phil Foden, the mighty, the genius that is Phil Foden. Dominic Solanke, 20 goals, 10 assists. Is he a little underrated, perhaps?
Well, Well, when you're a star at Chelsea, or a young kid that's got going to be given the luxuries of, you know, being a potential first-team player, doesn't find his way, ends up going to Liverpool, it doesn't work out particularly well. I think he scored one goal at Anfield and a number of games, goes to Bournemouth, had to go to the Championship to rediscover and get goals, which he did. I think the improvement of him has come a little bit with a new manager coming in that was well at Bournemouth. But because he got loads of goals in the Championship, that was never the only question was the same question that Ivan Toney has to face: can you go and do it in the Premier League? Well, he's got there, and he's much more experienced now. He's 26, Solanke, something like that.
26, yeah.
Yeah, 26. You know, so, and he's coming with the sort of belief that he's going to get goals. Where when I saw him as a younger player, I didn't think he had that. I felt just looking at him, thinking, you look like. I remember thinking of myself as a young player and thinking, I never quite believed I was going to get goals. Sometimes it would happen, but I never really believed it. And he reminded me of that. And now I look at him and think, now he knows about, again, being sort of the most important number one. And he carries a lot on his shoulders, but he's now ready enough for all of that. And he's been a fantastic, you know, story of a bit of redemption for him personally. Because when you get let go as a young player, you go on and you try and find your career. He's done that. He's found it at Bournemouth. And now he's looking like a player that I don't think will get in the England squad. I think there's been massive improvement, but I just don't see Gareth going that way.
Yeah. Well, coming back then, you've dismissed Solanke, and that's absolutely fine because I think that we knew where we were going. But talking about Kane's understudy, which is kind of how I teed this up, Alison, you mentioned about Ivan Toney playing with Harry Kane. Are we saying then that if say, and let's not even think about it because England are going to win the Euros under the mighty Gareth Southgate, but if... in his desperation to bring the title to Bayern Munich, when it doesn't look like it's going to, but Harry Kane injures himself. Who is the actual Harry Kane replacement? Is it Ollie Watkins? Because Ivan Toney needs a Harry Kane next to him.
For the reasons I said, I think it's Ollie Watkins. But I also see the argument that Toney would be a really good impact because he's the best player in the air in the league. Also, his penalties are...
But that's what I mean. In terms of understudy, is the idea that you would then replace. If there's no Harry Kane and we've got Ollie Saka Watkins on one side or Rashford and Foden.
Ollie Watkins all day. Because of the way he can stretch defence as well and he can link up. I just think he's the most, as I say, he's got the most similar sort of skill set to Harry Kane.
Alison, agree?
I would still...
You'd still go Tony?
I'd still go Tony, even though I think it would be better if they play together. I would still go for Tony.
You think Tony's good enough to link those players around him?
I think Tony's got more arrogance than Watkins, and he would not struggle with the amount of pressure that would be on you as England's number one striker.
I agree, but I think Watkins is actually getting there. Do you know, there's one thing I've noticed is that almost every time he scores a goal now, he runs up to the away fans. Even, you know, obviously he did it at Brentford, where there was a pointed thing, but and he obviously being a former Brentford player. He ran over to the Fulham fans and just stands there smiling, that kind of beautiful grin of his on the front of the fan. He's like, he is kind of getting a little bit more cocky.
Right.
And good.
That's no bad thing for a striker.
Tony Gold, final verdict. There's no Harry Kane.
My final verdict is, if you're going to play a one, it's definitely Ollie Watkins. If I play a two, I'd love to play the two of them together if Harry Kane weren't playing, because he could do the Mbeumo role at Brentford that he does brilliantly for Ivan Toney.
So England don't even need Harry Kane. Just play both of them.
No, if Harry wasn't obviously available, like you started with, I would be absolutely prepared to go the two of them because I think they'd scare the life out of teams.
Is he only? Do we agree that he's only going to pick one though?
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
What, take one?
Watkins,
I think he might
one.
Try and take two. I think he might try and take Watkins and Toney.
But the reality is that, you know, they might both go and not play a minute.
Yes, yeah. That's very true.
So if you're bringing wide players, you know, someone like Marcus Rashford, if in form, a bit more flexibility. That's the other thing. That's the other string in Watkins.
Can I just say, is this you, a Scot, getting excited about a debate around an England squad? Because this sounds suspiciously
like it.
I'm
always really supportive until they get to the final. That's the other thing about Watkins too, is that before Brentford sold Neil Mopai, he was a winger.
So
he has that string to his bow as well. He could come on and, you know, if you're really chasing a game... and play wide.
Just add one little thing on that as well, is that, you know, you will play if you're at Harry Kane's understudy. Normally you would, because in Qatar, obviously Callum Wilson played.
Yeah.
You know, and you probably will get game time.
If you're lucky enough to be 5-0 up or whatever,
Yeah. Well, he played in one of the games,
didn't
he? Yeah, we should mention, for Newcastle fans screaming at their phones at the minute, Callum Wilson is in this top 10 of Premier League goals and assists since last season with 31, but I've slightly discounted him because he feels a little bit old and like he's injured. Anyway, moving on to another striker in the goals, Rasmus Højlund. He's done it. He's turned it around. A couple of weeks ago, I was praising him on this podcast and Martin Samuel laughed at me. Ha! Pal, leave it out, will you? This is a test to see whether he listens on Monday now, to see whether he's going to have a go at me about his impression. But Rasmus Højlund, 6 goals on the spin, Tone. And the youngest player to do it in the Premier League. Younger even than the mighty Erling Haaland. Are you impressed?
I was, because as I spoke about in the piece today, that getting his first Premier League goal on the 26th of December and thinking... One thing that stood out to me about him was that he joined Manchester United where they had no alternative or experienced striker within the camp. So it's like this young lad who's brought in. And I remember Dwight York going to Manchester United in 98 and he walked into a dressing room with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, Teddy Sheringham and Andy Cole. Right, so you've got a lot of competition there. He's had none, Højlund, but he's also had no experience of help from strikers or, you know, people that might be on the sort of way down but trying to, you know, help him grow as a player. He suffered a long run, barren run of not scoring. And that going into December is a long time. Late December, that's a long time. So I remember thinking, this is going to be a real test of his character. How he's going to get out of a slump. The team wasn't playing well. He wasn't as effective. But you can see there's quality there. And what I thought he led the line brilliantly. Against Luton. Physical, his touch was great. He looked like, I mean, even his second goal, some might go, that was a lucky deflection. He actually looks like he meant to.
I was going to say, Strikers Union, you're backing him all the way.
Well, he looked like he meant to give it the old shoulders, like he's dancing.
I'm not against it. I've thought the same, I've got to say. But it's interesting you talk about coming through that tough period, and Alisson, to link it back to our previous discussions around Virgil van Dijk and Kai Havertz and happiness and things. Erik ten Hag, after the match, was talking about the signing of Højlund. He said, "We are very happy with our recruitment and that we recruited the right character because he can perform under stress and when things go against him, like in the first half of the season. He has the ability and a strong character to be resilient, which is quite a striking thing for a manager to be talking about as such a young player as well. But it is evident, isn't it, when Gregor, you're talking about Ollie Watkins and that arrogance and that confidence. It's not necessarily arrogance that we see with Højlund, but a determination. Mm-hmm. When he scored that first Premier League goal against Villa, the celebration was just sheer unbridled, both relief and exuberant joy. Yeah. But now he's giving it the... look at my name, spin round to the Luton fans, isn't he? And what a kind of transformation that says for a guy who's backed himself ultimately.
Yeah, no, and I think you'd have to have a heart of stone not to feel pleased for him. I was there for his United debut and I felt sorry for him because most of the chat was about, is he fully fit? Because he had a long-term back issue. And it felt like maybe he was getting on the pitch earlier than he should have done. Was he completely fit? And I don't think he was completely fit. And maybe he wasn't utterly fit in that long barren spell, Tony. Mm. But what I think he always showed was that willingness to run and be involved and to work hard. And I was probably more impressed with his effort against Luton as opposed to his goals. Because one goal you'd have to be an idiot to miss and the other one... let's say, was freaky in the build-up.
Well, some of his Man United teammates missed a similar chance in the second half.
That is true.
There's a couple of idiots in
there. Slightly idiotic. But it was more that, you know, you've proven a point, you've scored 2 goals, it's only Luton, she said, putting inverted commas around it. And yet he did not treat it, he didn't coast at all. And when you're young, that's one of the traps you fall into, isn't it? Oh, I've made it now. I've broken broken Joe Willock's record. I'm all right.
Joe Willock must be fuming, by the way.
I'm not sure you'll know who Joe Willock is.
He will. I back him.
But it's possible, isn't it, when you're that young? So it's why Ten Hag was right to point it out. It's about attitude. It would be easy to coast, and he didn't coast. He continued to work very hard, and I do feel that United came perilously close to dropping points at Luton, and one of the reasons they didn't was that Luton they had to worry about Højlund.
Mm. Absolutely. Gregor, you mentioned when we had a debate about the top 4 earlier in the season, you said, it's just the Manchester United. They're just Manchester United. They might come. And the front cover of the game today said United on the charge, 4 wins on the spin. Is Højlund going to drag them into contention for the top 4? Still a couple of points behind Tottenham and Villa, but both those teams slipping up kind of in turn almost. Is Højlund going to be a catalyst for United to get to
Well, without
four.
His goals, it would have seemed very unlikely. But now, with that and the sort of just a bit of a shift in mood around the club because of the investment and, you know, all the talk about appointments off the pitch, the idea that Man United are actually going to be a kind of properly functioning football club, it's possible.
What do you think about that personality thing that I mentioned? Having bigged up Ollie Watkins so much, what do you look at when you see Hoyland? What do you see?
Tenacity. Like, the way he's, when he holds the ball up again, he's great with his back to goal. He kind of like...
Mark Hughes, you know, sort of.
Yeah, like, he's almost like he's got a fistful of the defender's jerseys. He's really, really dragging them down and poking balls off, like, laying balls off and then spinning in behind. It's like real all action. And when I was writing that piece about Watkins, I was thinking, who else? You know, I was saying he was the most complete striker in the Premier League. I was thinking, who else could who else is in the running for this? Haaland, if he was, you know, Haaland is Haaland, and we don't actually see a lot of the things that Haaland can do because he's playing for Manchester City. He's asked to just do nothing for half an hour at a time or whatever. But having watched Hoyland then later on that evening, I was thinking, yeah, Hoyland is an all-rounder as well. Mm. I'm not sure he can. Well, I've not seen it yet, but, you know, Watkins could score a worldie from outside the box, and, you know, he's someone who links play brilliantly, then gets in the box and he gets in the end of things. But he's got a lot of strings to his bow as well, and he's starting to look like a really good signing for United.
There you go, Rasmus. Just need to knock one out of your feet from 25 yards and bang it in the top corner, and Gregor Robertson thinks you're as good as Erling Haaland. Moving on, we're going to finish with Mason Holgate and the horror lunge that gives Brighton a gift, as the Times headline writes this morning. I thought this was fascinating. A chance for Chris Wilder going into a home game, having beaten Luton. I was speaking to Ian Whittle beforehand, before the game, when I was editing yesterday, and saying, this has got to be the chance, hasn't it? This is the chance for Sheffield United to have the tiniest little, most positive run. And then in flies Mason Holgate over the top of the ball, sent off after 10 minutes. It was fascinating as well to hear Chris Wilder say that he's maybe going to be fined. He's apologised, came straight out. There was no kind of trying to mask it.
I don't know. There was two contradictory interviews he gave. The first one, he was saying there'll be some older guys today watching this thinking, you know, in our day, he might have got away with that. And, you know, he was...
But we're not,
one interview,
but we're
he was
not in their
that.
Day, are we? We're not in their day.
He did say that. He did say that. He did say that. He said, you can't do it anymore. But I'm not sure you could ever do that.
No. But it's madness. It was. We're just checking. No one in this room thinks that was even in any way an unlucky tackle. The Defenders Union?
No, but what it was the kind of tackle that we've seen not so long ago, where a player tries to take the ball and then clean out the man, but he missed the ball completely. Yeah. So, but you can't even do that. If you won the ball, you couldn't do that. Yeah. That's the difference. That's what Wilder was getting at. You used to be able to take the ball and clean out the man, but because you got the ball, it didn't matter. Now it doesn't matter if you get the ball. If you go in that kind of recklessly, you're off.
Ever done anything that daft early in a game, Tom?
No, I've been. Do you know how many times I've been sent off?
I think we have done it as an intro, but maybe I'll do it next time. But go on, tell me. Six.
Nine.
Nine.
Ooh, nine.
Yeah, three.
I knew it was more than Gregor.
Three for dissent.
Yeah.
couple of elbows in there.
Yeah.
So, I wasn't the greatest tackler, if I'm honest.
Just left that to the other lads, to be fair.
Well, I just wasn't great at tackling. I tried it. I never come off very well in tackling. David Webb, who came to Chelsea as an interim manager for about 6 weeks, done a tackling session, and he called me aside after and went, I've seen some bad centre-forward tackles, but yours are down there with up there with the very best. But, yeah, no. You didn't need VAR, did you? You didn't even have to ask VAR on that one. But they got that wrong. That'd have been the end of football with VAR.
In terms of Chris Wilder, then, this is incredibly difficult for him, isn't it? Because I was also watching it, and I was speaking to Martin Hardy, who'd been kind of watching their Newcastle game when they obviously capitulated and lost 8-0. You can see those two goals, and everyone in the office is going, it's going to be 8-0 again. And they held firm just for a little bit and then conceded towards the end. I mean, it makes it incredibly difficult for him, doesn't it?
Yeah, and he's had a really frustrating time because they played Crystal Palace away and they were leading twice, and Eze and Olise got one of the goals in the game and caused them problems, and they lost that 3-2 and he was really frustrated. And then obviously they lost to Villa 5-0, and then they go to Luton and put in a really spirited performance and win 3-1, and I know that he felt, we've got to back this up, we just have to back that win up, because that was a big day for them winning at Luton. They were playing a team that got promoted. They got them sort of, you know, nearer to Burnley, as in a relegation battle. And he was just looking to catch somebody. He wanted to catch whoever in front of them. You know, whether it was Burnley, and then whether we get to Burnley, can we get to Luton or can we get to Everton? You know, and he was thinking like that. And of course, it just fell up. Then once the tackle was made, he tried to tighten it up. It's a tough one. I mean, I don't know what you can say, because Holgate's not even a young, naive lad. He's
been
around
the
block
a while.
What is he, 27 now, something like that?
Can we think of any other daft tackles? Chaotic?
Daft tackles.
How many daft tackles did you make in your career? Or will you stay on your feet, shepherd them out of play, concede a throw-in?
I was thinking about this
morning. You were, weren't you?
I was thinking about this morning. I had one against Elliot Bennett. Do you remember he played for Wolves,
yep.
Brighton, Norwich, Blackburn?
I do.
He was on loan at Bury. In fact, ironically, Alan Nil was the coach of Bury then. And he was young and very fast. And we were both running for the ball, and he just slipped it into like sixth gear or whatever. And I lunged, and it was pretty high and reckless, and it was straight red. And like, I think it was in the first half.
But was it was that a desperation just trying to bring him down, or did you actually?
Yeah,
try and nail
him? He slipped it into, you know, a higher gear, and I thought, I'm not catching him here, and I lunged, and yeah, I caught him pretty high, and it was a straight red, and but not very often. That was. Ridiculous. It's hard to think of a worse tackle than that in recent years. There are
Harlan Keane couple of tackles were pretty severe, weren't they?
Yeah, they're pretty bad. Way, that's a different category of stupid, I think. let's not get into the merits of Roy Keane on it, Alfinger Haaland. You've given me another nickname for you now. First gear. Anyway, first
Second
gear,
game.
The postie, National Rail, and the ice cream van man. Thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. Join us on Thursday, when you're going to see whether I've got the bottle to give Martin Samuel a nickname or not. See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.